Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. For modern sports fans, it's hard to imagine a time before you could get every score on your phone in real time, or instantly watch endless highlights packages to dissect every aspect of a major sports moment. But not that long ago, there wasn't a single all-sports television network, let alone the dozens we have at our disposal now. Perhaps that transition was inevitable considering our advanced technology and increasing passion for sports, but somebody had to be brave, and perhaps a little crazy enough, to be the first to put a 24-hour sports channel on the air. That man was fired Hartford Whalers communications director Bill Rasmussen, who became the founder of ESPN in 1978 and somehow put the fledgling network on the air a year later. Since then, ESPN has become a global force in sports and the coverage of sports, a multi-billion dollar industry with near dominance on the airwaves, online, in print, and even in its partnerships with major sports leagues themselves. Rasmussen has several ties to the WAMC listening area, having begun his sports media career at UMass Amherst in football and basketball, and later spending a decade on the air in Springfield, Massachusetts. He's also the author of Sports Junkies Rejoice, The Birth of ESPN. And tonight, he'll speak at Union College in Schenectady about his life and career. The event begins at 6. Bill Rasmussen, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thanks, Ian. Glad to be with you.
What are your memories of working in central and western Massachusetts early on in your career?
Well, it was kind of an interesting time. As you accurately point out, we didn't have networks for all of those kinds of things. And when I went to work for a radio station back in Amherst, Massachusetts, where the university was located, we said, let's do some football games. And the university said, sure, why not? Because there weren't all these big rights fee things that we have today. And then I said, you know, let's find out what other radio stations are around in the state of Massachusetts. And we ended up doing a little 10-station radio network. And I guess you could say that by accident that was my first network experience. But I was young and eager to do sports and to branch out into television. And in a matter of a little over a year, one of the NBC station in Springfield was the number one station in ratings, and their sports director left, and he recommended that I take his place. So I kept trying to just learn more and more about television and radio, and it just seemed like every day was a learning experience. And I guess I continue to do that to this day, and it's a passion with me, and I've just enjoyed not only the ups and downs and all of that of in and out of radio and television. It's kind of a volatile industry, as you probably know. And the ESPN days were just a continuation of that.
At what point did you start to think about the idea of an all-sports network as being a good idea for sports fans, or what was the thought process that went into the founding of ESPN?
Well, I can tell you that the trigger was being fired by the Hartford Whalers and the World Hockey Association on Memorial Day weekend in 1978. That was the end of the 77-78 season. They missed the playoffs, and they dismissed just about the entire front office, and I was one of them. And while we were still working with the Whalers, I was their communications director, and we'd begun talking to Connecticut Cable Systems about carrying the Whalers. They were headquartered in Hartford, of course. And as we talked about that, and then I got fired, I said, well, we're not going to talk about hockey anymore. But we said, you know, there's a lot of really good basketball in Connecticut. Maybe we can do something in the state of Connecticut to put basketball on. We had UConn. This was back before the days of the Big East, but UConn was still the power in the state. But there are a lot of other schools, Wesleyan and Yale and Fairfield and Central Connecticut, Southern Connecticut, quite a few. We thought it'd be a nice idea to see if we could do some of that. And we began talking to the University of Connecticut's athletic director, John Toner, about that. And in the course of all of these discussions, all over the first week or 10 days after I was fired, we were talking to the manager, the vice president of the local cable system in Plainville, Connecticut. It was a United Cable System. They were headquartered in Denver, but he was the local guy. And he said, you know, I don't know very much about this. I'm not sure anybody knows much about it, but there's something called the satellite coming, and we won't have to do these local loops like the phone company has to do. You'll get one signal to one place, and I'm not sure what happens to it, but it's going to be a lot more reasonable, and we can do a lot more things with it. It's very versatile. Why don't you call New York? And so he said, when he said that, I first I thought, who's going to listen to me at RCA? I'm a little guy that just got fired in Connecticut, but guess what? RCA was in business too, and they were looking for somebody to help them sell this new communications technology. And so it was kind of the perfect storm of they needed somebody that was, what, brave enough, smart enough, or crazy enough, take your pick, to try and do something for 24 hours. And we said, well, we're going to do sports for 24 hours because we know there's a market for that, and we know there's a, you know, a ton of NCAA schools playing sports, and if we can get them to be the anchor, we'll be in business, and that's exactly what happened.
Well, if you read about those early days of ESPN, there was a lot of sports getting covered that wouldn't be covered otherwise unless it was a 24-hour hole to fill. Was the idea that there was a market available for a 24-hour sports network the kind of thing that you had to sell to that same market? In other words, showing people that, hey, you do want this.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, the first reaction whenever we said something to anybody that hadn't heard of it before was, who's going to watch 24-hour sports? So as soon as they said that, we knew they didn't get it. Because nobody's obviously going to watch 24-hour sports. It was, sports will be available 24 hours a day, and if you happen to get home from work at 1:30 in the morning or 2:15 in the afternoon, it doesn't make any difference. There'll be something there. You won't wait until the weekend for the one or two football games that you might see. And so we did have to do a great sales job, even to the point of we started from the moment we went on the air, the principle was that the subscribers, the cable systems would pay us a nominal fee for the subscribers, and in exchange, we would give them some local availabilities that they could sell to their local businesses and create a new advertising income stream. Even that, the first time that we started talking about it, I can remember vividly the first guy that we talked to about it said, why would I want to do that? I'd have to hire a salesman. We said, precisely, and you pay him 10% and you keep 90%. I don't know, they said, I'm not so sure this is going to work. Well, we heard a lot of that. I'm not so sure it's going to work. But from the very beginning, we had to sell the idea that, A, there were enough people to watch sports, and, B, there were enough quality sports available to fill the network. And everybody at the time, the naysayers, were all saying, can't be done, not enough sports, who's interested, and so on. Well, as we know today now, ESPN has not one, but 52 networks around the world.
It's amazing.
So it was a very overcoming the status quo and having to sell the idea into the cable systems. But once they caught on, boy, they jumped on board in great numbers.
So when you see ESPN today, how close is that to the vision that you had back in 78, 79?
Well, it's actually very close. We had a presentation. It's interesting you asked that question because I was talking. I get back to Bristol, you know, periodically, especially around anniversary time in September. And we were talking about the initial presentation to the NCAA in October of 1978, and it's a printed presentation. And on the front it says, this is what we're going to do, more sports to more people, you know, more exposure for your student-athletes, more games for the fans to watch, et cetera, et cetera. And today their mission statement is basically the same. It's to serve sports fans anytime, anywhere, more and more sports. That's all they talk about. So from that regard of what the mission was, it's virtually identical. The difference is the technology. When we went on the air, we didn't have computers or fax machines even. We had to do everything by telephone, personal visit, or put a stamp on an envelope. So we didn't know about internet, and we didn't know about computers and high definition and digital this and phones that are now more powerful than everything that we had in the station at the time, in the building that we had there in Bristol. So with the exception of the technology, which is still doing the very same thing, delivering more sports to more fans than anybody could imagine, that part's identical, but the technology has just exploded. And actually, it's the technology that has made it, as you mentioned, as we began, it's just dominant the world over because they own more than half the sports rights in the world. They're so big they can do that. It's an amazing phenomenon. Did I ever think it would employ 6,000 people and that 4,000 people jobs would be created in Bristol, Connecticut? Of course not. We knew it would be something that the fans wanted, but technology has just exploded it around the world.
You know, if there's been criticism of ESPN, it's been that relationship with holding rights, covering the same leagues that, in essence, you're in bed with to you know, $1 billion degree. So what do you make of the role of ESPN covering these leagues and getting in bed with the leagues to bring their games, you know, to the air, and then simultaneously also being the number one news outlet covering these leagues?
Well, it's an interesting question. It's always an interesting dilemma. And what they try to do, obviously, is the commentary and so on is separate from the actual news of the league. There are those who say that, you know, ESPN is basically buying the rights and telling people when they're going to play and so on. But, in fact, that was what the networks were doing, the big three networks were doing, even though they only did 25 games or so. They were dictating the same things. They would strike a deal with, the first one was then NBC and the NCAA back in the 1950s. And the NCAA would dictate when they're going to, you know, hear the games. And then the network would say, well, we can't play it at that time. We have to do it at this time and so on. And that developed the idea of the various windows on Saturday afternoon. And eventually it led to actually to congressional action saying the NFL plays on Sunday and colleges play on Saturday. So this idea of, quote, being in bed with the leagues that you cover and so on, it's unfortunately for those who see something negative in it, it's a necessary evil. Fans want to see everything and hear everything. They also want to hear the negatives. And I think ESPN does a pretty good job of, if it's a bad game, it's a bad game, and they say so. So they do walk a delicate line, but I think the people that are covering the games, not the people that are buying the rights, keep a pretty good line between them.
I wanted to ask you a question about the recent oral history book that came out about ESPN. Mm-hmm. Those guys have all the fun. And I wonder,
Jim Miller's book, Miller and Tom Shales.
Correct. A really fascinating read. And if you're a watcher of ESPN, it gives you an interesting window into it. I wondered if you felt your legacy was adequately reported in that book, because to me as a reader, it seemed like there were a lot of people who wanted to take credit for what ESPN became. And after the early pages of explaining your role in the founding of ESPN, that was sort of left behind. I wonder if you agree with me.
Yeah, well, I think there was one line that Jim put in there, the author, Jim Miller, about if the six people who were president over the first 30 years of the corporation hadn't been the guy in exactly that order, it probably wouldn't have worked, because we were six distinctly different people. I had to chuckle to myself, as you were saying, a lot of people are taking credit for it. There are some folks who think ESPN was founded in 1984 because that's when they heard about it, and golly gee whiz, they went to work. So what else happened before that? There was one book written, I know, that talked about ESPN, the company. Then the story starts in the mid-80s, and the author never even picked up the phone and called me or asked anybody at ESPN if I was available for a comment or anything, which I found was kind of interesting. So there are a number of people who want to claim credit and on, and which is fine. I mean, that's human nature. You know, rewriting history is wonderful. But from my point of view, you know, I was there and walked on the site that today is a beautiful campus right after it had been planted with grass, and it was a redevelopment area in Bristol. I was there when the NCAA signed the contract. We had all of the elements put in order to put ESPN on the air between the time I got fired in Memorial Day weekend of 1978. By March 1st, we had a contract signed with the NCAA, with RCA for the satellite, with Getty Oil for the money. Budweiser had already committed to the biggest advertising contract in cable TV history up to that point. And we had several multiple system operators already signed on to provide subscribers as they brought them online. So I look at the first 8 months before most all of the other people that are talking about it had ever heard of it. We had all the elements in place. So it was enormously satisfying to see the last pieces fall into place and know that come September 7th, we were going to go on the air. We knew we had some logistical problems, like building a building and a few things like that. But I hear frequently, and if you look online, you'll find a lot of people claim to be the founder. And I know one fellow calls himself the founding producer. Well, so be it. So he was there when we started. I really don't think about all that stuff very much. It's if you talk about the founding of the company, and somebody else wants to take credit for it, well, that's fine, but it simply isn't true.
Do you watch ESPN?
I do watch ESPN, but I don't watch much television, oddly enough, because I'm traveling. I like to read. I travel a lot. It's kind of fun when I go into a hotel room, for example, to look and see the directory and see that ESPN is on there maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 times, depending on which chain it is. And I think back to when we first went on the air and I was still traveling to get cable systems and so on. We used to see signs outside hotels and motels saying, "We have HBO." And then pretty soon it started to say, "We have HBO and ESPN." And so when I see it today where it's all printed in all of the directories and hotels all around the world, that's kind of intriguing. But I, to answer your question directly, I don't watch much. The show that I like that they have, I played baseball for a long time. I'm a big baseball fan, and Baseball Tonight is the favorite show. Although SportsCenter, obviously, if you want to find out what's happening, you have to at least watch a segment of SportsCenter for a little while to get caught up.
I'm with you on Baseball Tonight. That's Bill Rasmussen, founder of ESPN. He'll be at Union College in Schenectady tonight with a presentation about his life and work. The event begins at 6 o'clock. Bill, it's been a real honor to talk to you, and thanks so much.
Well, Ian, thank you for taking the time to chat with me.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.